What was really interesting about writing the book is I did a lot of research on both the historical time period, World War I, post-World War I, but also on traditional folklore. And part of the fairy folklore is that they can't tell lies, but conversely, they're always trying to trick you.
That's Maria Corrigan, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Maria Corrigan studied English literature at the University of Edinburgh and earned a Master of Publishing degree from Simon Fraser University. She joins us to talk about her debut novel, Thistlemarsh. Maria, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us about the story that readers are going to find in Thistlemarsh.
So Thistlemarsh follows a nurse just after World War I, and she is set to inherit her family home, but there's a catch. She needs to fix it up within a month or she'll lose it forever. Pretty quickly, she discovers that she won't be able to fix it up within the month, so she makes a deal with a fairy, an irritatingly handsome one, and together they have to use magic in order to fix up the house, but there may be something else going on trying to fight back against them.
So there's a lot going on in this novel, and I'm curious, first of all, about inspiration. I mean, this is your debut novel. You could have written about anything. Why did you decide to tell a story that involved fairies?
Well, I've always been more on the fantasy side, and I also, at the same time, growing up, watched a lot of period dramas with my grandmother on PBS. And so it was kind of a natural thing for the two of them to come together into sort of a fantasy period drama. It didn't help that during when I was writing it, it was COVID. So I think I was relying back on things that I loved growing up for comfort. And so they kind of naturally folded together into a story taking place in a manor house and with magic.
So this story takes place right after World War I, which is, I would assume is a big time of disillusionment, that you've gone through a world war, she's suffered tragedies within her family, and even though early on, as you write, she wanted to study fairies, she really doesn't believe in magic that much at this point in her life.
I think that's definitely true. She's very disillusioned after the war, especially because she has lost her cousin, who is very close to her. And then she is also dealing with the fallout of her brother being injured in the war and suffering from pretty extreme PTSD.
So let's talk a little bit more about this character, Mouse. She starts out wanting to be a fairy anthropologist. She wants to study fairies, and she, as you pointed, gets disillusioned by the war, and she has to give up on that dream. So she is, I guess, a person like a lot of us that maybe start out in childhood or young life, have these big dreams, but then real life imposes on it. She has to give those up, at least for now, until real life intervenes again. So tell us a little bit more about her character and why you think readers will identify with her.
I think that she is, in a very interesting way, quite a practical person at this point in her life. While writing, I know that for me personally, I always feel that if people aren't making decisions that make sense in a story, I get frustrated. And so even though Mouse knows that making a deal with a fairy is ill-advised because of her experience with being interested in fairy anthropology, and also that her mother was very interested in fairies, she's sort of forced into this situation. She's quite desperate. And I think that there is something appealing about that. Somebody who's quite practical and used to making decisions sort of not really based on what she wants, but what's for the best, being forced into a position where she needs to make a decision she might know is bad. She's also very compassionate. So she's a nurse, and even, you know, after the war, she is still incredibly compassionate to, I think, most people that come across her path. She's not looking at people necessarily as just black and white. She tries to keep an open mind. There are some exceptions to that rule in some of the characters that she already might have a history with. But I think that that will be relatable to an audience. And I think also she does still want to believe in magic. She still does have this kind of wish to return back to the way things were. And so I think that a lot of people will feel that way. I know I do. And so, you know, maybe it's not possible, but she does have that kind of optimism. And I think we're kind of her trajectory over the course of the book is one of healing. And so I think that will also appeal to people.
So I think there are a lot of themes, and I want to talk about that in a bit, that the book explores, but also a lot of symbolism in that, to me, as I was looking at the story, sort of her rediscovering fairies in a way and getting involved with this fairy is a symbol of hope, really, coming out of the despair of World War One. And it's like, that's kind of like healing and thinking that, well, maybe there is a future out there that's brighter than what she just lived through. And I'm also thinking about Thistle Marsh itself, because it was a house that played a big role in her childhood. And in her childhood, she was sort of in her prime. Thistle Marsh was in its prime. They've both gone through World War One. They're both needing a lot of renovation. They've both been very neglected. So it seems like there's a parallel between Thistle Marsh and Mouse.
Yes, definitely. And I think a lot of the characters in the book are kind of experiencing the same trajectory. And so Thistle Marsh itself is dilapidated at this point. It's been neglected after her cousin has passed away. Her uncle kind of just let the house go to ruin in his depression. And so Mouse is now coming back to it, kind of. It is sort of a reflection of how she feels inside, in that it's crumbling and it really needs some TLC, and she kind of can't do it by herself. And so I think that might also be a bit of a reflection of her, where, you know, she's trying, she's muscling her way through. She, you know, has the kind of weight of the world on her shoulders. She has to care for her brother, but, you know, she can't actually do it by herself. It's an impossible task. And so that's why she ends up turning towards fairies and magic. And I think that that is something that we can all sort of relate to, especially at this point in time. It's like, you know, we need to rely on other people. We need to, you know, reach out in order to achieve a kind of sense of healing.
But there's a big issue of trust here, because here we have Thornwood, and she needs him because of this deadline that's looming. But she knows she really can't trust him. On the other hand, as you pointed out, he's really attractive. So that also kind of colors her judgment. And maybe she enters into a deal with him that she might not otherwise have done had he not been so attractive.
I think, to be fair to Mouse, I think that she might have done it anyway. But yeah, so I think what was really interesting about writing the book is I did a lot of research on both the historical time period, World War One, post-World War One, but also on traditional folklore. And part of the fairy folklore is that they can't tell lies, but conversely, they're always trying to trick you in order to get the most out of the deal, or, you know, leave you kind of on the back foot while they take what they want. And so she knows that, because she has had this experience learning about Fae and wanting to be a fairy anthropologist. And so she goes into this knowing that she can't trust him. But at the same time, as the story goes on and they work together, they grow closer. And I think a mutual respect sort of grows. But at the same time, you know, there's always the underpinning that it's like, okay, this is in his nature. He is a tricksy guy. And so can we trust him? Is he going to make a selfish decision? Is he going to do something that's going to, like, undermine Mouse? We'll find out.
Well, this story is very atmospheric in terms of the big role that Thistle Marsh plays in the surrounding area. Were there any particular bits of architecture in real life that sort of inspired this environment?
Yeah, so I did a lot of research on houses, and luckily there's some really good resources in the National Trust in the UK, and then also lots of documentaries, which is great. But the two that stand out to me is Hardwick Hall, which is famous for, it's like an Elizabethan manor, and it has these giant windows. And so at the time, even in the 1600s, it was called Hardwick Hall, More Glass Than Wall. So this was a real change in how British homes were constructed, because they were no longer needed for defense reasons. They were ostentatious instead. And then the other one that stands out is Burghley House. So people might know this place from the 2005 Pride and Prejudice. It's Lady Catherine de Bourgh's house, especially the interiors. And so it has all these beautiful spires, and it also has those big, beautiful windows. And just it's very ornate, but it has a history of there were things there before it became this big, ostentatious Elizabethan house. There is a medieval history. And so when I was researching these, I was like, okay, well, what's the difference between a hall and a manor house? And what do these things mean? And so as I was crafting Thistlemarsh, I wanted it to have a history that predates what the house looks like now. So, you know, it has Georgian elements, it has Elizabethan elements, but there's an ancient history there related to fairies that dates back further into the medieval time.
Another inspiration that ended up in this book is a dog, Aspen. Tell us about how that played out in the book.
So Aspen is my dog. She's a wonderful little Aussie, Corgi, Collie mix, amongst other things. And I spent a lot of time with her when I was writing the book. I was home, like in my childhood home, writing my dissertation, and COVID happened. It was all closed down. So there was a lot of one-on-one time with Aspen. And in the course of the story, we meet some creature that's sort of dangerous, who then becomes a very warm and welcome and friendly and loyal character. And so that was inspired by my beautiful dog, Aspen.
I mentioned earlier that there are a lot of themes you explore in this book. We talked about some of them, you know, like her need for rehabilitation. She has to face a lot of personal issues, etc. Tell us a bit more about some of the themes that readers will find in this book.
So again, healing, I think, is an important theme. Also, something about forgiveness. I mean, so Mouse and her uncle have a very strained relationship, and he's passed away at the beginning of the book. But when she was growing up, there was this resentment towards her from him, because she is the, you know, as close to illegitimate as you could get in the eyes of the aristocracy without actually being illegitimate. And so her mother left the aristocracy to marry her father, who is a gardener, in a kind of Sybil and Branson from Downton Abbey way, but they don't have the support. And so he, the uncle, sees her as like the worst parts of both her father and her mother. And she grew up with that. And so she has this big chip on her shoulder sort of throughout the book, and especially at the beginning, where she feels less than, she feels like everybody is looking down on her. And then I think that over time, she sort of realizes that it really wasn't about her, and that like also these people could have good traits. So there's that forgiveness element, as well as I think just sort of an idea of moving forward. So, you know, there's all these things in the past that are holding her back from doing what she actually wants to do. And so there's a self-discovery element there too.
There is a question I like to ask authors of fiction, and it's this. If you could spend a day in real life with one of the characters from your novel, who would it be and why?
I think it would be Mouse's best friend, John. He was, I think, the most fun character to write. And what's particularly appealing about spending time with him is that he is just a very reassuring presence, but he's also happy to challenge people. So, you know, he's always like pushing a little bit, being an entertaining conversationalist. He is a vicar. And so in a way, you would expect him not to have an interest in the fairy world, to be opposed to it. But his stance is more, you know, belief is important regardless. And so his grandmother believed in fairies. He grew up, you know, with a fairy background, but he's also a man of the church. And so he has these kind of entertaining philosophical ideas that it would be fun to talk to him about. I would like to pick his brain about what he thinks about certain things.
Well, congratulations on having this book out there. I'm curious, now that you've got this experience under your belt, what's next for you?
Well, right now I am working on books in the same world as Thistlemarsh, but focusing on different time periods. And so that has been really fun. I love doing the historical research, and it's fun to dip back into this world with, you know, its established fairy lore.
Well, this current novel is Thistlemarsh by Maria Corrigan. Maria, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.